Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Nigella Hillgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And tonight it's my pleasure to welcome you to the latest Perspectives on Ocean Science Jeffrey B. Graham lecture series. And it's a great pleasure that I have to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Lahini Aluihwari. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about her before I ask her to come and speak. She actually began her foray into marine science at a pretty young age when she was doing her bachelor's at Holyoke University. She went to, dare I mention it, that other place, Woods Hole, on the East Coast, as an intern in the summer, and she went back there, I'm afraid to say, to do her, not really, her graduate degree, her PhD. And she actually then came to Scripps for her postdoc, and everyone thought so highly of her here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography that she, a year later, became an assistant professor, and I think in 2008 it was that she became an associate professor here. I was actually fascinated to learn a little bit more about her tonight. I knew that she had been born in Kandy in Sri Lanka, but I didn't realize that she had spent the rest of her childhood actually in Africa, in Zambia in Central Africa. And I also didn't know that, though I should have guessed, that she had spent some of her school years in England. She went to boarding school in Chislehurst in Kent for high school. And as I'm English myself, and I also went to boarding school, I'm full admiration that she survived that experience. And that may be why she decided to come to the States for her undergraduate degree. So she went to Holyoke, and now she lives in California, as she puts it, with her husband, her new son, two fabulous and large mutts, and a cat. So it now gives me a great pleasure to introduce her and ask her to speak tonight about microbes of the deep, tiny organisms with a global impact.
Well, thank you, Nigella. It's true that my childhood was much more exciting than the life I lead now, except, of course, for my two dogs. Today, I'll be talking to you about microbes in the deep ocean. This is the title after some major intervention by the folks at Birch Aquarium to their attempt to make my research a little bit more interesting to all of you. It's actually quite difficult to be sandwiched in between the sharks lecture and Greg Rouse will be speaking next week, who works on worms that inhabit the carcasses of whales. So, you know, talking about something you can't see is a little bit more challenging. So microbes in the deep ocean, tiny organisms with a global impact. It's important to point out right now that I'm an ocean chemist attempting here to talk about microbes, and so you'll have to take my perspective, which will be a chemical perspective. And in reality, what I'm going to talk to you today about is the role of microbes in the marine carbon cycle. You know, obviously you wouldn't have come to see this talk if you saw that maybe, or the role of microbes in ocean productivity. And again, this is very much from a chemist's perspective, so forgive me if you were here to learn more about biology. So what are the... I'm going to launch right into it, and I would prefer if you kept the "you lie" comments till the end of my talk so that... But if you really have to say something, please go ahead and do so. So the basic elements of marine production are... And this is really the basic. Here we start off... thinking about ocean production by thinking about carbon dioxide, which enters the ocean, as most of you know, from the atmosphere. In fact, the oceans play a really important role in sort of tempering the atmosphere's carbon dioxide budget. Okay, so carbon enters the ocean. And together with things that I'm just going to call fertilizer here for your... to make things easier, but in reality, if we want to be more specific, we're talking about things like nitrogen, phosphorus, iron, cobalt, zinc, a variety of different elements are important, but I'm going to focus on the major elements here. So this is how we start. And then, you essentially have a process called photosynthesis, which most of you are familiar with, and that occurs in the sunlit surface ocean. And you have transformation of what we call inorganic carbon and nutrients into the marine biomass. And when you can think of this simply as a bunch of carbohydrates, proteins, fats, lipids, all bundled up in cells. And some of these, this biomass exists as particles, and some of this exists as what we call dissolved molecules. So just snot. Let's think about snot in the ocean. Okay, and in the surface ocean, in terms of marine production, in order to sustain this production, you have this cycle where things like bacteria, microorganisms, and macroorganisms like zooplankton and even way up in the food chain, such as fish, recycle this marine biomass back into the constituents, carbon dioxide and fertilizer. If you didn't have this recycling, okay, you wouldn't be able to sustain biological production in the ocean. You wouldn't have fisheries. And if you didn't have this recycling, you wouldn't be able to actually... And the extent of this recycling determines how much of this carbon dioxide is actually stored in the ocean in a way that it can no longer interact with the atmosphere. That would be called CO2 sequestration in the ocean. Okay, what I'm really going to focus on today is that a fraction of this marine biomass, a significant fraction, actually leaves the surface ocean and enters the dark ocean. Okay, the understanding of these processes are critical to any understanding of ocean production in the ocean. Here, microorganisms primarily transform the biomass into the inorganic constituents. And in terms of the fertilizer, nitrogen and phosphorus, it's really this process that's important for much of the production that takes place in the ocean, because that's what delivers this new fertilizer back into the surface ocean so that the cycle can start again. So the key elements are essentially the understanding that everything is cyclical on Earth, right? And the only things that enter the Earth is energy from the sun, and the only thing that leaves the Earth is heat, and everything else has to be recycled. So all of your chemical elements, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and this is recycling in the ocean, but it happens everywhere. And the timescales of that recycling can be vast. Here we're looking at timescales that are relatively short, between 0 to several thousand years. Okay, so it's this recycling that's important, and really, we know that this occurs. We can see that in general measurements of the chemistry and the biology of the ocean, but we really don't know. It's still a black box how these transformations occur. Okay, and in terms of this in this context, microbes essentially reuse and recycle. And why is this important? Well, maintaining marine biological production and biological carbon sequestration depends on the efficiency and the location of where this recycling happens. How much of the carbon is actually being recycled to CO2, and how much of your proteins and your sugars and your lipids and your DNA is being recycled back to your fertilizer. Therefore, biological and chemical factors that control the extent and rate of this recycling must be understood. And that's really sort of the crux of my research, mostly from the chemical side, but the biological side is actually what's the pretty face of my research. It's what the general audience may be actually able to understand better, or even myself, maybe I can understand it better. But the chemical controls, we really know very little about. And what do I mean by chemical controls? Well, it turns out that the composition of your proteins and your sugars and your fats and your lipids is actually important to how quickly microbes can eat it and how well microbes can use it. And so that's actually a very substantial part of my research, looking at the chemical controls. But the biological controls, while we know that microbes are important for the recycling of carbon and nutrients, much of this actually hasn't been proven in the field. There's been a lot of bottle experiments, for example, that show the processes that must be at work, but actually demonstrating that those processes are occurring and where those processes are occurring is still something that has yet to be done. And so without, you know, taking it back to the big picture, without knowledge of what factors control these different processes, trying to understand how things like climate change perturbs the marine carbon cycle and marine production in general cannot be predicted. My version was this rather cartoonish one, and this is the pretty version that you see in a lot of places. And essentially the details are the organisms that are involved in all these different transformations. Phytoplankton, or algae, are the first step in the production of this biomass, okay? And bacteria are very important in the role that they are recyclers. But bacteria are also important because a substantial amount of them supply food at the higher trophic levels. So in terms of marine production, including fisheries, these bacteria can be very important as well. And of course, the extent of how much food is available for these higher trophic levels is determined by how quickly and how efficiently the nutrients and fertilizer are supplied back into this system. So what we're going to really focus on then is the fraction of the carbon that's leaving the surface ocean as biomolecules and entering the deep ocean. What are the transformations that occur here? Okay. And what's also important about this is that the stuff that doesn't get reused and recycled escapes and is buried in sediment in the bottom of the ocean. And why is this important? Well, all the oil and gas that you use in your cars and we use to give us electricity, that all came from the fraction of organic production that escaped this recycling and was buried in sediments thousands of millions of years ago. Okay, so in terms of putting carbon away in the sediments on really long timescales, we need to understand how much of it escapes the cycle in the deep ocean and enters the sediments as well. So there's a variety of different processes here that are important. So before I go into the meat of my talk here, I want to bring up some relevant features of the marine water column. You may be quite familiar with some of these things, but if not, here's your chance to learn more. So typically, we think of the surface ocean as a 0 to 100 meter part of the upper ocean. And the reason that's specifically considered the surface ocean is that's where light, the depths to which light penetrates in most of the ocean. And so that's where production through photosynthesis can occur. The rest of the ocean is considered the dark ocean, and the twilight zone is often referred to as also as the mesopelagic. It's defined often as 100 to 1,000 meters depth in the ocean. And this area is very important because there's intense transformations that occur here. And even the bathypelagic ocean, the deep ocean that's often thought to be is quite static, has proven itself to be quite dynamic as well. And again, in these regions, microbes really dominate the transformations that you come across. And of course, there's marine sediments where carbon is deposited as solid. So here's the only little bit of chemistry you're going to see. What's photosynthesis? Well, most of you probably know this, but it's taking inorganic carbon dioxide, in the presence of light, using light energy to make biomass or organic carbon. This is photosynthesis. This is also the major source of oxygen in the atmosphere because oxygen is produced in this process. Much of that oxygen is then utilized in respiration, okay, where organic carbon is burned back. This is the reuse and recycling back to CO2. Those are processes that occur in the surface ocean. This process occurs in the dark ocean as well, respiration. And in fact, respiration is very important in the dark ocean. And it's hypothesized and it has been demonstrated that there is something like photosynthesis that now occurs in the deep ocean as well. But there's no light there, so it's not light energy that's used for this process, but chemical energy. People have known about this type of process occurring around hydrothermal vent systems, but it's only been very recently, probably in the last 10 years, where we've found that this type of process occurs just in the open, oxygenated deep ocean, so most of the ocean, really. And here you have carbon dioxide, the inorganic carbon, being produced to organic carbon using the energy derived from chemical transformations. So here is a new source of organic molecules, and this cycle is pretty much confined to the dark ocean, okay? Primarily the dark ocean. And then, of course, respiration. So just these are photosynthesis on respiration in the surface ocean, and then what we call chemosynthesis, chemical-driven production of organic matter and respiration. Okay. In terms of what's going on with the carbon and the inventory of carbon, this is very important as well. This shows the relative sizes of how much carbon here is fixed, or through photosynthesis, how much carbon is produced during with photosynthesis in the surface ocean. This is how much carbon that's produced from photosynthesis leaves 100 meters. And you can see that a lot of that carbon pretty much disappears in the dark ocean. But we don't know exactly where that how that disappears, and how quickly that disappears. And much of that carbon is converted back to CO2. This can also be drawn, a similar figure can also be drawn for nitrogen and phosphorus. And then a very small fraction, about 0.1% of all of this is buried in sediments annually. Okay, so that's how the carbon pyramid works in the ocean. Okay, and there's a couple of things to also just a few facts to keep in mind. Microbes change in terms of their abundance. This is about a million cells per milliliter, and they decrease by about an order of magnitude in the dark ocean. So they're still quite abundant. They're working pretty hard, we know this, but they're doing that even in the absence of light and even in the absence of huge carbon production. Okay, organic carbon concentrations aren't that too different between the light ocean and the dark ocean, but it's important to remember that this is what standing around in the water is as organic molecules. The fluxes are much larger in the surface ocean. Okay, the fluxes are essentially what we saw in the figure of carbon fixation. Okay, so there's a big difference between when people report concentrations versus fluxes, how quickly things are being transformed. Okay, and then in terms of fertilizer, the nutrients that drive production, there's really, in most of the ocean, there's none of that accumulating in the surface ocean. Most of it's found in the dark ocean, and therefore the regeneration of this fertilizer by microorganisms is a critical process in terms of driving production in the surface ocean. Okay, so getting to my research, in the deep ocean, you can study the role of light-independent microbial transformations of relevant chemicals in isolation. So you don't have the confounding factors of photosynthesis and respiration in the surface ocean here. We can really look at what the unique transformations that occur in the absence of light. And what is unique about the approach that I've brought into this kind of science? Why do we think we might learn something new? It's a reductionist approach. Instead of focusing on large organisms or big geochemical fluxes, we're really focusing on things that I'm going to talk about in a second, isotopes, molecules, and genes, really the things that you can't even see with a microscope. And then the other part of it is that it's really an interdisciplinary approach. You hear this word a lot, and a lot of people do have an interdisciplinary approach here at Scripps. Here we try to use a combination of chemical and biological tools to study how microbes transform carbon. And instead of doing it in a bottle or on board ship, we're really trying to get a sense of what's happening in the water column where these organisms are living. So getting a snapshot of their life in the deep ocean. Okay, so I'm going to go through some relevant scientific terms, and for those of you who know this, I apologize, but just to get everybody there and so I don't have to watch what I say. Okay, so we often talk about atoms, isotopes, and molecules, and I'll talk about what each of these things are. So when we talk about atoms, we're talking about things like carbon. When you see CNPSI, that's just the atom. Okay, it doesn't tell you anything about what type of molecule that is. It just tells you that it's that type of atom. In terms of isotopes, not all carbon atoms are created equal. Some happen to be a little bit heavier than others. So C13 there is heavier than the 12 carbon that you see there. And because it's heavier, it moves a little bit more slowly through the through the carbon landscape of the Earth. And so biological and chemical processes tend to favor the light isotope over the heavy isotope. So in my research, we can really capitalize on that difference, just that small mass difference, to learn a lot about processes that occur. And that's not just for carbon, that's true for nitrogen, for phosphorus, for silica, any really element you can think of, they all have isotopes, and the isotopes behave differently. Carbon also is interesting in that it has a, what we call a radioactive isotope, carbon-14. And many of you probably have heard about carbon dating, you know, how you look at how old the Shroud of Turin might be, or some, you know, a mummy discovered in the tombs in Egypt. So it's, we can use that same concept. So in this case, while carbon-12 and carbon-13 never get removed from the Earth's system, carbon-14 actually goes away, decays into nitrogen. Okay, so that actually puts a time stamp on things. You can use the amount of carbon-14 that's in something to get a sense of how old or how quickly that carbon is interacting with other carbon on the Earth's system. So it, that's nice. You can get rates from something like C14. And a molecule is something like carbon dioxide, where you have several atoms within that molecule. So just to clarify those different terms, this is going to be more of a chemistry lecture than anything. I'm also going to use the terms organic versus inorganic. And when I talk about organic, I'm not talking about vegetables grown without pesticides. I'm really talking about biochemicals, things like proteins and carbohydrates. Those are organic molecules. And inorganic is something like carbon dioxide. Okay? There's also other important inorganic molecules in the ocean, like nitrate or ammonia. That's your nitrogen fertilizer. Phosphate is your phosphate fertilizer. And then I may also refer to something called a biomarker. Biomarkers are biochemicals that are synthesized by particular types of organisms, and they carry in them the information of both what organism synthesized them and what type of process that organism was involved in. So chlorophyll, for example, is a biomarker. It's a biomarker for photosynthesis. Only organisms that photosynthesize contain chlorophyll. DNA is sort of a very general biomarker. It's a biomarker for living organisms. Okay? There are some really interesting biomarkers, I'll touch on them slightly, which are lipid biomarkers, so fats essentially to you and me, but they different organisms make very specific types of lipids, and you can actually get to the species level using lipids in particular cases. So biomarkers can be very useful for someone like me. Okay. Then I'm going to talk about autotrophy versus heterotrophy. Again, something that's probably familiar to many of you. In the case of autotrophy, that's when an organism takes inorganic molecules and converts them to organic molecules. So photosynthesis is autotrophy, production of biomass from carbon dioxide. Heterotrophy is what you and I do. We go around and actually eat other organic molecules. So we might produce inorganic chemicals, but our primary mode of survival is to ingest organic molecules. And many bacteria are heterotrophs. Okay. Then photosynthesis versus respiration. That probably should have come earlier in the talk, but most of you should be familiar with this. Using light to make organic matter from inorganic material. Respiration is the production of inorganic material from organic matter. Okay, so respiration, degradation, remineralization, you'll hear these words a lot. That essentially means producing your inorganic molecules or your starting materials from a biomass. When I talk about microorganisms, we often talk about microorganisms primarily as a size unit. Okay, it's essentially an organism that's smaller than 1 micrometer, which is 1 × 10⁻⁶ meters. Okay, something very small that you can't see without a microscope. I'm also going to talk a little bit about genes, and in the context of this talk, you can think of that as just a piece of your DNA that contains in it some kind of biochemical recipe that tells the cell how to make proteins or enzymes. Okay, it's just a biochemical recipe in this case. And I'm going to talk about archaea and bacteria. And these are two of the three domains of life. For a long time, we thought archaea were primarily present in what we call extreme environments. Okay, places like hot springs and hydrothermal vents. And it turns out that they're quite ubiquitous. They're present throughout the ocean, and they actually seem to have a very unique role, especially in the deep ocean. Okay, and I'll refer to them here collectively as microorganisms. Okay, and I'm happy to talk more about any of these things at the end of the lecture. Okay, so let's talk about these biological carbon transformations and what I'm focusing on. So here's just a cartoon of all the different types of organic matter you might find in the ocean. We have phytoplankton. We can think of particulate organic matter, aggregates, sinking particles as other types of detritus or biomass. There are dissolved molecules, and I'm not going to talk about this much except to tell you that the most abundant type of organic matter in the ocean is present in the dissolved form, and that's actually mostly what I study. And then there's, of course, zooplankton, and then the microorganisms, bacteria, and archaea. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on in the surface ocean, a variety of different transformations. And so what I really want to do is get away from all that confusing stuff in the surface ocean and focus on processes by looking really at the dark ocean. Here, the main input of biomass or organic molecules comes from sinking particles from the surface ocean. There's also a significant fraction of this dissolved material that sort of moves with the water. So for bacteria, which are the dominant organisms here, okay, they have to eke their living from either the dissolved molecules or the sinking particles. And people have talked about these organisms living a feast and famine existence. When there's a rain of particles from the surface, they may be able to really get kickstart their metabolism. And when there's absent, then the particles are absent, they sort of just hang out there waiting for something to come by. But the question is that really true? Do they really have this feast and famine existence, or can they use this other stuff, this dissolved stuff that's always there, to fuel their production? Okay? So the question is, what are all these arrows, how are they connected, and how does that lead to this recycling of nutrients and fertilizer that comes back to the surface ocean to start the ocean production cycle again? Okay? So without that cycle in the deep ocean, you're not going to be able to maintain production in the surface ocean. That recycling is very important, and so how those arrows are connected is still unknown. Okay, so the goal of finally getting to my research in the last 10 minutes of the talk, and again, I want to emphasize this is a really small portion of what I do, and so I'm happy to talk about all the other things I do as well. In fact, I don't think none of my students currently actually are that interested in bacteria, but. The idea is to illuminate carbon transformations by the archaea and bacteria in the dark ocean, okay? So what was our approach? Okay, so getting to the science. We filter really large volumes of water, and I'll show you in a second what I mean by large volumes of water, to isolate bacteria from their environment. In situ, we isolate these bacteria, and then we basically bust them up and take out their molecules, DNA and lipids, okay? And this is what I mean by a reductionist approach. I really don't, in a way, care about the cells themselves. I just care about what's inside of them. And then I do some isotope measurements. And again, I'll go into what I mean and why I do these isotope measurements and what it actually entails. So why will this approach work? It's never been done before in the deep ocean, but we were pretty sure that it was going to work in the sense that it was going to tell us something about carbon transformation that we hadn't learned before, and that was because the different carbon pools that bacteria and archaea can interact with, the different transformations that occur in the deep ocean, have very different isotope signatures, and I'll talk about this in a second. Okay, so how do we sample water? And when I talk about sampling lots of water, I'm talking about filtering more than 5,000 liters of seawater at a time, okay? So perhaps the most enjoyable way in which we did this was, not surprisingly, the most lucrative study, was to go to Kailua Kona in Hawaii, where they have the Natural Energy Lab of the Hawaii Authority there. And they're very unique in the sense that it's the only location on Earth, really, that has deep water. You open up a tap and you can get water from 670 meters and 915 meters depth. I mean, there's nowhere else in the ocean, in the world, that you can do this. And it's literally gallons and gallons and gallons of seawater. And of course, they didn't do this just for me. It was there because they were trying to use it as a way to maybe as an alternative energy source for cooling, because the water that's coming up is, you know, it's somewhere between, you know, it's about 6 degrees Celsius. Okay, so it's very cold. And actually now they're bottling this water and saying, because it's apparently so so pure, but I won't really go into that. I have my own opinions about that, because I've actually, you know, there's bacteria in there, 10 to the 5 cells per mil, in fact. Anyway, so there's, at the time that we went, it was just a shack that was set up at this lab, and we were pretty much the only people there. And you open, except for the people that were making the very large shrimp in the next door. They also use the place for aquaculture. So, and Roberta is shown here. She was my graduate student at the time. She's a postdoc now at Caltech. And essentially, we opened up the taps and we connected the taps straight up to these filters. And there's two filters. One filter removes out large particles, and the stainless steel filter is what gives us the bacterial cells, okay, and alkyl cells. So essentially, we turn on the taps, we go away. Well, she went and hung out at the beach, come back at nighttime, make sure the water's still flowing, we know what the flow rate is, go home, eat dinner, swim in the pool, come back the next day. Do this for about 10 days. And in total, we sampled about 50,000 liters of seawater, okay, at that location from these depths. And usually science is much harder than that, but we got lucky on this first one. And this is actually the other end of this is the least enjoyable way to get thousands of liters of seawater. This is when you don't have a tap, okay? Here you have these bottles. Most of you have seen this. These are called Niskin bottles, and in this case there's 24 on a rosette. You cock them open. You can see they're actually open here. They open on the bottom, and they open on the top. You send it down to the depth that you want. You close all the bottles. You bring this thing up. You can see there's actually a hydro wire. That's what connects it to the boat. The winch takes you down to the depth that you want. Anyway, you bring the water back up, and you can see that same filter set here, but we just connect it up to these bottles, and we sit out a deck. And this was actually July, and the Eel River margin. You'd think it would be a little bit warmer, but because of the type of work that we do, because we send this thing over and over, we deploy this at least 10 times a night. We tend to do everything at night when everyone else is sleeping, and so it's really cold. And she did not like this. But this is how I'm not going to talk about the species, but this is how we use the same sort of approach to look at microorganisms that utilize methane in the water column above these methane seeps, which is also a really interesting study. And then more recently, we've come up with a really nice method, and this is great because we can do this anywhere now that we want, and we don't have to use this approach. And so this is just a pump. Okay, here, the biggest and heaviest part of this thing is a battery. Okay, it sits in a titanium housing, and the battery lasts about 24 hours, and it's heavy. And this thing can go down to 6,000 meters on a wire. And you can't see both filters here, but those same filters are on the system. There's a small pump that's housed in a titanium housing, and you essentially put a battery in this thing, you send it down to the depth that you want, it sits there and it filters until the battery dies, you bring it up, take the battery off, send it back down. And this way, it just filters and filters until you've had enough water go through it. There's a flow meter that tells you how much has gone through it, and you bring your filters up. So these are the three different ways in which we collect our samples, and this has really been wonderful because it's really made things more achievable. It allows us to go really into the deep ocean now and look at things, not just in the mesopelagic. Okay, so here, let's go to the science. Now, everything here is summarized in one figure, and I have to say that this work really took 6 years of several people working constantly on it to actually get it to work, which is why nobody's really done it before. So let's hope that it was worth it. So in this case, we're talking about the Hawaii samples. So those are our filters. And I'm showing you the size here. And I just want to point out that in oceanography, a lot of times we do everything by size fractionation. Phytoplankton are collected on a filter of a particular size. Okay, so then we say, okay, that's the algae fraction. So in this case, we're looking at organisms that have a diameter between 1 micron and 200 nanometers. Okay, so they're very small, and they are, by definition, microorganisms. And within this fraction, you primarily have bacteria and archaea. So we do the filtration on site. Okay. Then we come back to the lab and we take these filters and we essentially soak them in very caustic chemicals that allows us to break the cells open. It doesn't destroy the biochemicals, but it breaks the cells open. And that allows these biochemicals to essentially be released into solution. They were inside of the cells before, now they're in solution. We do a bunch of different cleanup methods. And in this particular study, we were trying to separate DNA from particular lipids specific to the archaea. Okay, so this is an example of a biomarker. It's a type of molecule that's specific to a type of organism, in this case the archaea, and it allows you to really probe what those organisms do at an individual level. And then we take that DNA and the lipids and we make what we call isotope measurements, and we do some molecular biological analysis, i.e. we look at the types of genes that's present in the DNA of these organisms. So that gives us something about what their metabolic potential is in the deep ocean. So in addition to getting these chemical measurements, we get sort of a portrait of the potential metabolism of these organisms as well. Okay. So I said that this approach works because the different pools of carbon that are present in the deep ocean that can be transformed by these organisms have different, what we call, isotope signatures. And here we're looking at now the radioactive isotope of carbon, and I'm not going to go into the details of how it's measured and what these different, what the actual units mean, but I'm happy to talk about this because this, I do this a lot. So here I just want you to see that different carbon pools in the ocean, specifically, I apologize for this, the inorganic carbon in the deep ocean, the particles that are coming into the deep ocean, and in this case, the organic molecules that are dissolved in the deep ocean, all have very different carbon-14 signatures, and that's demonstrated sort of in the colors here. Okay, so essentially, we've got different signatures for each of these pools, and so that should allow us to trace how organisms interact with these pools. How is that? Well, the bottom line is that inorganic carbon, sinking organic particles, and dissolved organic molecules each have a unique radiocarbon content, or 14C content. And that's because the time scales on which these different reservoirs interact with atmospheric CO2 are very different. So that's really the information that's carried in that measurement, and I spend a lot of time actually thinking about that measurement itself and what that means. But because they have these different 14C contents, microbial interactions with these carbon pools are essentially etched. Okay, they're etched in the cellular biomolecules. So by looking at the carbon-14 content of cellular biomolecules, I can get some information about which carbon reservoirs these organisms interacted with. So you need to know what your different carbon reservoirs are. You need to know what their unique radiocarbon content is, and then you can get a sense of what the microbes are doing. Okay, so I apologize, but I have to show data. And I'm only showing two data points, so it's really not anything too amazing. And I will walk through what I'm trying to show you here. So I'm going to show you data primarily from the mesopelagic, so the deep part of the mesopelagic. This is depth here, so it's around 700 meters and 900 meters. And we chose this region because you really have intense carbon transformations here. This is really where your flux of carbon coming out of the surface ocean really shows the largest changes. This is where you see large increases in the inventory of your fertilizers, your nitrogen and your phosphorus. So we know there's a lot of microbial recycling going on here, but we really wanted to get a sense of exactly what was happening. There's a lot of information. So on the x-axis here, we have the 14C content. Just think of that purely as 14C content. In the dashed lines, it shows you what inorganic carbon, and you can think of this as just the CO2 in the deep ocean, looks like. It's not really accurate to call it CO2, but just for the purposes of this discussion, okay? And then in the solid line is what the dissolved molecules, what their 14C content is. So the idea is, let's look at these microbes and try to get a sense, where do they fall in the context of all of these different carbon pools? And here is the carbon 14 content of the particles that is sinking into the deep ocean. And essentially what we found is that in some parts of the ocean, okay, microbes have a signature that's very similar to the inorganic carbon. What does this mean? This means they're actually doing something like photosynthesis. They're taking inorganic carbon and making organic molecules. And so this is sort of a unique carbon transformation that's occurring within these waters. They're not relying on the particles that are being produced in the surface waters, but they're making their own food down here in the deep ocean. Why is this interesting? Well, we didn't think that much of that was going on in the deep ocean. It means that these organisms are very efficient. They can do it in the absence of light, again, which is not an easy feat. You need a lot of energy to fix carbon in the absence of light. Okay, and at this depth, it looked like much of the microbial community was relying on that type of process. And then at other depths in the ocean, you have particles, okay? This is the sinking particles. You have contribution from both this in situ carbon fixation and transformation or carbon access from the particles that are sinking from the surface ocean. So it shows that microbes are very much, that they do rely on the organic carbon that's sinking out of the surface ocean on particles. And even this chemosynthesis, the synthesis of new carbon in the deep ocean, I won't get into this, actually does rely on the particles that come out of the surface ocean because they use nitrogen that's coming off of those particles to actually fuel their metabolism. And we tried to look at the genes in the DNA that we measured for C14. So this is the geochemical measurement here on the left. And on the right is sort of the biological measurement. We looked at the genes that that show bacterial abundance. And these are this is what we call quantitative polymerase chain reaction, PCR, analysis. Looked at the genes that compared the genes for bacterial abundance at the two depths, genes for archaeal abundance at the two depths, and a particular gene that we know is important for this chemosynthesis, this making of new carbon in the deep ocean. And what it showed is that archaea were more abundant at the depth where you had the formation of new carbon, the chemosynthesis, and not surprisingly, the gene that may be involved in that chemosynthesis was also more abundant at the same depth. So here, at the 700-meter depth where we have DNA that looks like inorganic carbon, we have two very different pictures for the archaea and the genes that are involved in chemosynthesis. So basically, the molecular data essentially confirmed what we were seeing from the geochemistry. It's a very simple demonstration. It took 6 years of very hard work to get here, but it's nice to see both proxies, both the measurements, which are very different, giving you the same information. So essentially what we're saying is that, going back to that picture of what's happening in the deep ocean, it's these two arrows, bacteria accessing the sinking particles and archaea actually taking this inorganic carbon, the arrow going this way, okay? Those are the two major transformations that are occurring here in the deep ocean. Again, we knew that this was somehow occurring. We knew this was occurring because sinking particles were going away. But we had no actual demonstration of that, direct demonstration of that process, okay? So in terms of the results here, and I'm almost done, this study was the first direct sort of demonstration of the recycling of particulate carbon by microbes in the dark ocean. There have been bottle experiments that suggest this occurs. Okay, there's indirect measurements, but this was really the first time we were able to show carbon going from a particle into bacteria. Okay. It's also the first direct demonstration of chemosynthesis, this formation of new carbon in the deep ocean by a major fraction of microbes in the dark ocean. Again, there was evidence that this was occurring, probably only for the last 10 years or so, but this was the first time it was shown to be important in the deep ocean. We've also looked at methane consumption using a similar technique. Okay, and we're hoping to, you know, in terms of expanding the areas that we're going to look at, we want to look at hydrothermal plumes and regions in the ocean where oxygen is low in the water column. What I do want to show here, point out here, is that, you know, I showed you two data points that showed that the different different processes were occurring at those different depths. And I'm actually, the study comes from a very quiescent part of the ocean. It's what's called the subtropical gyre in the North Pacific. There's not a lot of productivity in the surface ocean. So the fact that things are varying there, even over the you know, in the matter of a few hundred meters, means that, you know, things are pretty variable, even in a part of the ocean which we thought was relatively unexciting. Okay, so there's still a lot to be done, because I've only done this really in two places in the ocean. Okay. So I'd like to expand by making sort of what we call depth profiles. So instead of just having two depths or three depths, I'd really like to get a good sense of, you know, looking at this bacteria, where the recycling of carbon is most intense, at what depth, where are we really getting the production of these nutrients and CO2. And then, you know, I'd like, you know, we're in the process of collaborating with real biologists and trying to bring some of these observations back into the lab and understand the different types of carbon and nitrogen metabolism by looking at microorganisms on the lab bench. And Doug Bartlett here has as a way to do incubations at high pressure, so you really get a sense of deep ocean metabolism, so that's something we're going to be working on. So just to finish off here, I specifically want to acknowledge Roberta, who was the graduate student that toiled for those 6 years to really make this happen. She, as I said, she's graduated since, and now she's at Caltech doing a postdoc. I have a variety of collaborators all over the place, and then funding sources. And again, this is a really tiny sliver of what I do in the lab, so please feel free to ask me anything else that you have might have an interest in. Okay, well, thank you. So the question was, the fixed nitrogen inventory in the ocean has doubled since the Industrial Revolution, and have we observed any effects of that in the ocean itself? And that's true, yes. It is true that as much nitrogen is coming in from rivers and streams as is fixed annually by microorganisms in the ocean. What has been demonstrated, and there's a lot of research in this area, and I've done a little bit of it myself, what has been demonstrated is that a lot of the fixed nitrogen, and by fixed nitrogen we're talking about things other than nitrogen gas. It's nitrogen and nitrate and ammonia, which can actually be used by organisms. That coming in through the ocean looks like much of that's actually utilized in the coastal ocean. So yes, the coastal ocean is suffering a great deal as a result of this. We've seen massive phytoplankton blooms. We've seen changes in the community composition. So certain organisms or phytoplankton that were common before the Industrial Revolution may not be as common, and they may often what we also see is a dominance of a single type of organism. Okay, so things like the red tide on the East Coast, where you actually have toxin-producing organisms, that's thought to be related to the input of nutrients from rivers. I mean, again, there's a lot of science going on to actually connect these things, but it is interesting that much of that's really confined to the coastal ocean, such that most of the open ocean does not appear to be as affected. There seems to be some discussion about atmospheric deposition of nitrogen being important in places, for example, like the closed basins like the Mediterranean Sea. But again, there's still a lot of work being done to show that that's really an issue. So the question was, what might ocean acidification do to the processes that I was talking about here? We don't have any data right now, one way or another. You know, the important thing about ocean acidification in terms of the processes that I talked about here is probably the effect on certain types of algae that calcify. And they're actually very important for one of the processes I talked about here, which is that for particles to actually sink from the surface ocean into the deep ocean, so that one single connection between the surface ocean and the deep ocean organic carbon pump, you need ballast, essentially. And, you know, things like dust from the continents provide ballast. And the other ballast that's often provided is by calcium carbonate, which is the shells of these algae. And also diatoms produce a shell made out of silica, which is not as affected. And there is some discussion that by increasing ocean the acidity of the ocean, it'll be corrosive to these calcium carbonate shells, which in turn might have an effect on carbon flux from the surface ocean, because there is actually a strong relationship between carbon flux and calcium carbon content. But, you know, I'm not going to say one way or another, but the jury's very much out on what the effect would be. There, we've seen effects going several different ways, because not only are what you do when you acidify the ocean is obviously increase the relative amount of CO2 gas that's there, okay, and that's usually a very small fraction of the total carbon in the ocean. So in addition to making it more acidic, you're also increasing the CO2 that's available for production, and so there can be competing effects of that as well to keep in mind. Okay, so the question is basically, what is the relative amount of carbon in some of these different processes that I've talked about? So, 50 gigatons or 50 petagrams, it's 50 times 10 to the 15 grams of carbon per year is fixed by algae in the surface ocean. Interestingly, this is about the same amount of carbon that's fixed by all of the plants on Earth. So algae, even though they don't happen to just accumulate in the system, they're just as productive as the trees that you see out there. About 10% of that leaves the surface ocean and enters the just below the 100-meter level, somewhere between 1% and 10%. Okay, so let's think about, so it's about 1 to 5 gigatons. And in terms of the archaea making new carbon, that the archaea new carbon production is actually a sort of a drop in the bucket in terms of what's entering from particle flux, which is why it was really interesting that we found a system where the microbes were not relying that much on the particles, but was relying on the carbon that was being produced in situ. Being such a small fraction of the total carbon that's entering the system, you wouldn't expect it to be that important for microbial ecology in the deep ocean. But in fact, it is, and that tells you, you know, that it may just be that those two processes sort of switch on and off. When there's not as much particle carbon, the chemosynthesis is important. I mean, there's so much speculation we can do about this, but yes, so in reality it's a small fraction, but it's actually very comparable to the amount of carbon that's coming in from rivers. It's comparable to the amount of carbon that leaves the ocean as particulate that's actually buried. So in terms of fluxes, it's comparable to some of the big some of the important fluxes in the system. The Arctic is very interesting for a variety of reasons. I don't have any plans to go up there, but there's a lot of people that have studied the archaea in the Arctic, and they appear to have some very unique properties. I am going to be studying archaea in the Southern Ocean. I have a collaborator at the University of Georgia in Athens, and the archaea in the Southern Ocean appear to be different in that they don't seem to be as important for chemosynthesis as the archaea that we've been seeing in the deep ocean. So they seem to have other ways of surviving. And there's differences between the summer and the winter in the Southern Ocean, and that's been of interest for a long time. What's interesting, though, is that the deep ocean just outside of our backyard here has the oldest water in the planet. So once you get to about 2,500 meters, the water has not seen the atmosphere for about 2,000 years. So here we have very old water. The particle, the amount of particles raining into this water is actually also very low. Okay, and so there's the opportunity to study really sort of unique processes in the absence of too much perturbation from the surface ocean in this system. And so I'm actually much more interested in studying really the interior of the North Pacific than I am anywhere else, except that it's not as exotic a place to travel to. But I mean, you know, the idea is to try to get as much data as possible, but ship time is very hard to come by. Okay, so the question is, in terms of carbon dating, what we're looking at, what we're measuring is the depletion of carbon-14 relative to an atmospheric inventory of carbon-14. So what actually, how is carbon-14 added to the atmosphere? So the main natural source of carbon-14 in the atmosphere is what we call spallation reactions, essentially cosmic rays bombarding nitrogen in the atmosphere. So N2 is, nitrogen is the most abundant atom in the atmosphere because nitrogen gas is the most abundant gas. And cosmic rays bombard that nitrogen and form carbon-14. So that's the new source. The source that has been of interest to a lot of us, actually, in oceanography is that when people did above-ground weapons testing in the 50s and the 60s, they doubled the inventory of carbon-14 in the atmosphere because it was produced during these radioactive bombs, when the radioactive bombs went off. And so that actually put a pulse of carbon-14 into the ocean atmosphere system that's really, you know, sadly, it's been quite useful for studying the rates at which these different things interact. So even things like how much C14 is being added to the atmosphere, C13 is being added to the atmosphere from fossil fuel burning has been helped from that process. But a lot of the rate measurements that we have in the ocean actually have benefited greatly from the above ground weapon system. At least we did something good with it. But just to mention, that intensity of bombardment in the atmosphere is controlled by the magnetic field of the Earth, and so there's been significant variations of that in the past, which means that the atmospheric inventory has varied in the past, regardless of the anthropogenic effect. So there's been a lot of variability, and that's something you have to think about when you think about looking at really when you're dating carbon dating, when you're looking for age.
Thank you very, very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.